We'll help.
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe.
Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
Aren't you ever dramatizing this situation?
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hey Planet Earth, what's happening? This is Terry Frost one more time, and this is Paleo Cinema Podcast number 70. How has everyone been? Australia's been hit by storms. Darwin got hit by a hurricane. That's by the way, we were going for our holiday in 2 weeks' time, so we were a little concerned about it. Nonetheless, I talked to my contact in Darwin, the inestimable Ivor Cole, who does the evening shift on ABC local radio in the Northern Territory. And he tells me that as cyclones go, it was a minor one from their point of view. Everybody just shut all the windows, stocked up on booze and food, and sat it out for a couple of days. They're very low-key up there and very casual about events, particularly given the fact that in 1974 the entire city got razed to the ground by a very strong hurricane. Or cyclone then. Anyway, on to the other stuff. Yeah, things have been going well here. As I said, 2 weeks from now, my vacation starts, and I will be podcasting on that Saturday. I'll be doing two podcasts, one of which won't be released for 2 weeks because I don't want anybody hanging out and getting withdrawal symptoms and forgetting who I am and all those other things that occur when podcasts go into a hiatus. It'll be a music podcast, and next fortnight, we'll be getting a proper podcast. The one after that will be another music podcast, and unlike Vince over at the B-Movie Cast, I don't have a couple up my sleeve, so I'm just going to roll with it and get two done in one day, and then I can just release the second one from, well, where will I be? I've got to work out where I'm going to be on my holiday when I release the next podcast. We'll be back from Darwin, so I will be at Broken Hill, the place where they filmed a lot of the second Mad Max movie. Normally it's desert, but given the amount of water that Australia has been inundated with over the last few months, it's probably a bit more like a green prairie or something like that. But anyway, we're going to enjoy it. We're in the last stages of planning it all, and we are going to look forward to it. I may even just do a little brief update. Check the Facebook. If you haven't friended me up on Facebook, please do so. Always happy to oblige on that. So I'll be doing Facebook updates with photos and things like that. So go with that. And so nothing much else has been happening. We're just kind of in that weird place just before all the good stuff happens. Now, let's start talking about what I have been watching. I'm going to load my Mizo up, which sounds totally filthy, but apparently isn't. Let's see what I've been watching. I'll go backwards from most recent onwards. Last night on ABC local radio Darwin, I talked with Ivor about Point Blank, the John Boorman directed Lee Marvin movie, and I've really got to podcast that one too. I've been a bit reluctant to overlap the radio gig and the podcast, but I may have to start doing that because Point Blank is a lot of fun, and if you haven't got a copy of the DVD yet, do so. Steven Soderbergh and John Borman do a fantastic commentary track about it. And for a movie buff or even somebody who's vaguely interested in the mechanics of making films, I definitely recommend that you check that one out. I watched a few episodes of the Banana Splits because I found a copy of the complete Banana Splits, that kids show from the 1960s, and grooved on a bit of childhood nostalgia there, and it was a lot of fun. I only watched a few episodes. I think I'm going to kind of dip into them a little bit, like very dark chocolate. You have a little bit at a time, but a bit of fun. 2 minute warning, I saw that Charlton Heston film, which has also got some cool people in it, like John Cassavetes, David Janssen's in it. It's about basically a sniper at a football game. Football's not my kind of thing, but Cassavetes was very good in it. Charlton Heston grit his teeth a lot, and Jack Klugman's in it, and they kind of got that big ensemble. Walter Pigeon's in it. It's worth spending your time. It's not fantastic, but it's not shit either. I saw Troll Hunter, which is the Norwegian film about a troll hunter, basically. And it's done a little bit the style of the Blair Witch Project, with that kind of mockumentary look. And I recommend it. It's a bit of fun. It's very different. It's a little bit like Rare Exports. If I was going to do a double feature of Scandinavian genre films, I'd go Rare Exports and Troll Hunter. So if you do get an opportunity to see it, do. It's not overwhelmingly, mind-blowingly wonderful, but it's really interesting. What else have I seen? I saw The Glass Tomb. I know the Hammerkus podcast just talked about The Glass Tomb. It's an old Hammer film noir from the 1950s. And, yeah, it's a little bit of fun. Jesus, censorship was bad in England in the 1950s, though. There were a lot of stuff that happened off-screen that didn't occur in Hammer films on-screen until well into the 1960s. But if you're looking to get a fuller picture of the history of Hammer films, definitely do so. And, of course, listen to the Hammerkus podcast. The episode with The Glass 2 Minute, I think, was the one with our very good friend Dr. Zom co-hosting along with Brian. And Zom and Pickleloaf are going to be doing their own podcast soon. They're both getting together, are going to put something incredibly wonderful together. I'll give you more details when that occurs, but I am very much looking forward to their podcast. What else have I seen? The Monster Squad. I rewatched The Monster Squad because it was on cable, and that was a bit of fun. For some people, it's childhood nostalgia. For me, it's adulthood nostalgia, but not shabby at all. And let me see what else. I've got a couple of other things. No, that's about it. I haven't put everything onto my Mizo yet, but I'm going to have to be a bit more assiduous in doing so. So, on to the films for today. What I am going to be talking about are two films that I found interesting. The first one I've talked about briefly in the podcast once or perhaps twice, L'Homme de Rio, That Man from Rio, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo, François Dauriac, Jean Servais, and Adolfo Celli, directed by Philippe de Broca. Definitely a fun action flick, and I'll talk more about that later. So that's the first thing. The second one is a movie written by two people that I find very interesting characters. The movie is The Last of Sheila from 1973. It was directed by Herbert Ross, and it stars, great ensemble cast, James Coburn, Richard Benjamin, Diane Cannon, James Mason, Raquel Welch, Joan Hackett, and Ian McShane. And it's a murder mystery thriller that was written by Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim. So that is the second one of the films that I'm going to be talking about. They're both interesting in their own way. They're very different in their own way as well. So nice bit of diversity there. It's very much in the paleo cinema kind of ages, in the sense that both of the films are sort of forgotten, but both of them are a lot of fun. I know our friend Vince has seen The Last of Sheila recently and highly recommends it. I think it was listening to him say that on the B-Movie cast that reminded me of how much I liked The Last of Sheila. And L'Homme de Rio is the kind of action film. There's a lot of shit in this film that other action films have borrowed from in subsequent days, including Spielberg and Lucas. They've borrowed heavily from it for the Indiana Jones films. And so going to have a bit of a chat about that. But now it is time for me to take a break and wet my whistle. And I'm going to be playing old Italian love songs as the interstitial music this time around. The first one is actually a new version of an old Italian love song. So if you're not into old Italian love songs, skip forward or suffer through this. It's Parlami d'amore Mario, sung by Patrick Fiore. And you might have seen it in some Dolce & Gabbana commercials recently, but it's a traditional Italian love song about a chick called Mario. And I'll be back soon, and we'll talk about the first of the two films, The Last of Sheila.
Come sei bella, più bella stasera, Mario. Splende un sorriso di stella negli occhi tuoi blu. Anche se avverso il destino domani sarà. Oggi ti sono vicino perché sospirar non pensar. Parlami d'amore, Mario. Tutta la mia vita sei tu. Gli occhi tuoi belli il brillano, fiamme di sogno scintillano. Dimmi che illusione non è, dimmi che sei tutta per me.
Something a bit soft and mushy for you. The Last of Sheila, 1973, directed by Herbert Ross. I'll play the audio at the start and just it'll give you a bit of a setup for what's occurring. A bunch of rich people are on a boat and their host, whose wife was killed in a hit-and-run accident yet unsolved, is playing parlor games. He's a game player. He thinks up games and puzzles and things like that, and he's playing a game with them. He is played by James Coburn, but here's the audio.
Well, I'm thinking of calling it... Don't be shocked, though. The Last of Sheila. Oh. Fox is interested, Paramount's interested. It's the perfect woman's picture. Every bit as big as Love Story.
Except she never gets to play that good hospital scene.
Well, Clinton, I think it's the picture we've been waiting for. If we're available, of course.
Yeah, well, provided they're not opening a new shopping center in Anaheim, you will. Ah! 2 hours to game time. Gang, let me describe the week's entertainment for you.
The last time I played a game was charades at...
At my house, a year ago, the night Sheila was killed.
As a matter of fact, everyone here was...
Was there. Except, Lee, you were homesick in Santa Barbara, you said.
No, I was homesick of Santa Barbara, I said.
I like any game where you don't have to move.
Well, you don't have to for this one, if you're smart enough.
Meaning?
Well, it's sort of I call it the Sheila Green Memorial Gossip Game.
Sounds fascinating.
I haven't even described it yet.
No, I couldn't have stopped.
No, I dreamed up...
Can't you take it, Joe? Come here.
Pay attention, please. Now, I dreamed up six secrets, one for each of you. Six little pretend pieces of gossip. Now, keep them secret.
Gimme, gimme. Can we look at them?
It'll help.
How do you think these things are?
Well, this one's only taken me a month to prepare, he said modestly.
It's marvelous.
It's what I've always wanted to be.
It says, you are a snoop. No. Don't throw it away. Keep them till Saturday and don't show them.
Anybody who wants to take a mine gets a kiss.
What's the game? Well, the idea is to discover everybody's secret. Without peeking, of course, and prevent the other players from discovering yours.
And how do we do that?
Well, every day we'll park in a different port where you can discover the proof of one person's secret. I'll announce what secret it is to look for and give you a clue, which will tell you what to do and where to go on shore. Now, if you solve the clue properly, it'll lead you to where the proof is.
Suppose you announce, let's say, pyromaniac, and let's say that's my secret. Why should I bother looking for the proof?
Because when the person whose secret it is discovers the proof, I'll put a card out saying the game for that evening is over.
And those who haven't found it don't score, right?
Right. Oh, if you could direct as fast as you catch on a game, you'd never be a has-been again.
What do we get if we win?
Better billing.
Let's play.
Ah! According to the old pizza slinger that runs this tub for me, the launch will be back to pick you up at 7 p.m. That's when you get your clues for this evening.
For whom are we looking tonight?
The person with the shoplifter card.
So that's the basic setup of the story. They're on a Mediterranean cruise, and Clinton creates the Sheila Green Memorial Gossip Game. So this was written by Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim in 1973. At the time, Perkins and Sondheim were an item. They had an affair for a time. And Perkins was bisexual, Stephen Sondheim was exclusively homosexual, and is still alive. And the movie was kind of inspired that he and Perkins, Sondheim and Perkins, used to arrange scavenger hunts for their show business friends in the 1960s in New York. And the people like Lee Remick and George Segal, were part of that. And according to Wikipedia, one of the scavenger hunts, the end of it was at staged in the lobby of a CD flop house, where participants heard a skipping LP recording endless repeats of the first line of the Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer song, One for My Baby, One More for the Road. It's 2:45. The winning team eventually recognized a clue, 2:45, and immediately headed for room 2:45 in the hotel, where bottles of champagne were waiting for them. So that's basically the sort of thing they did. They were creating scavenger hunts, and both of them were very much interested in puzzles and games, and together they got together and created The Last of Sheila. Now, the ensemble cast on this is pretty impressive. I like it, and they're all good, solid character actors with a couple of exceptions. I mean, James Coburn as Clinton, having very kind of passive-aggressive jabs at everybody while he's organising the game. Richard Benjamin plays a writer. Everybody who's on the boat, apart from Clinton, the James Coburn character, is kind of slightly on the skids, except Raquel Welch, who's a very famous and charismatic actress, and her husband, played by Ian McShane, is kind of the husband manager type. On there, got Diane Cannon playing an agent, and James Mason playing a director. Joan Hackett is the wife of the Richard Benjamin character, and she's the one with the money. So there's basically things go wrong during the game. There's a murder, and unraveling where the murder comes from also involves unraveling the hidden secrets in the Sheila Green Memorial Gossip Game. It's not too much of a spoiler to say that all of the little guilty secrets are genuine secrets that people on the boat have. The people who get the card with the secret on it, it isn't their secret, it's somebody else's. So there's that kind of... Clinton knows that one of them killed Sheila. He doesn't know which one. And so that, the revelation of that particular plot line involves unraveling the secret of the game. And there is a secret of the game, and there are clues for various things all around the place. So it's very much a puzzle kind of movie. And I like it too. The Mediterranean settings are interesting. Diane Cannon's outrageous and kind of bawdy producer's one of the outstanding people. Ian McShane as the almost toy boy husband, who's on slightly on the skids with Lee, played by Raquel Welch, who, I mean, I know, talking about Vince again, I know Vince is very much in favour of Raquel Welch, but, no, she's, I mean, yes, physically she's a very attractive woman, but as a character or as a persona, I never took to her as much as a lot of other people did. And the interesting ones are Richard Benjamin, who at the same time, this is around the same time as he did Westworld, so he was at the height of his career as an actor. He later went on to direct a number of things, but this is the kind of peak of his career as an actor. And Coburn is very smooth. He's kind of on the tail end of that very groovy 1960s that he had with, which started with The Great Escape and The Magnificent Seven and ended with films like Duffy and went on with things like Dead Heat and A Merry-Go-Round and Harry in Your Pocket and those kind of slick, smooth thrillers. Now, the director of the film was Herbert Ross, who didn't have a very kind of a stellar career but had a reasonable career in cinema. I'll just get his details together because I've got all of this printed out and reams of information on everybody, but it's not in any particular order. Okay, I eventually went to Wikipedia, so we'll start from there. Herbert Ross, here's some films that he did. They were good films and they made a bit of money, but you know, nothing fantastic. He did Goodbye Mr. Chips in 69 with Peter O'Toole and Petula Clark. Played again Sam the Woody Allen Thing in 72, The Last of Sheila 73, Funny Lady, The Sunshine Boys. He did The 7% Solution, a film that I really should do for the podcast. So I do like that film. Nijinsky, Pennies from Heaven in 81, Footloose, which I never liked, Steel Magnolias, ditto, True Colors and Boys on the Side. So yeah, a good career without being fantastically distinguished. I mean, Footloose was a popular hit, but I just didn't buy it. And he does a good job here. Basically, he just has to aim the camera at the people and let them do their thing. There are and the ensemble works. I mean, they do very much give the impression that they've known each other for a long time. And there have been various relationships between various members of the party, and they're all very intelligent, literate people. Some more successful than others. Some are on the skids, some are not on the skids, which is an interesting place to be and makes them a bit vulnerable to the machinations that Clinton brings into the game. And when the murder does occur, without saying who the murderer is, the unravelling of it is an interesting thing. Now, I'll tell you what the secrets are in The Last of Sheila. I won't tell you which character had which secret. They were in no particular order, he said, looking up his list. Little child molester, alcoholic, ex-convict, homosexual, informer, and shoplifter. So those were the secrets that people had there. One of the criticisms of this film, looking at it from a modern viewpoint, is that most of the problems that people had, most of the secrets, they were all supposed to be relatively minor transgressions. But the one that stands out, of course, is little child molester. We now have a different viewpoint on that than people had at the time, and maybe a better understanding of it. But at the time, they were intended to be kind of minor transgressions, as it says in the movie, which, of course, we now know is not the case in this one. And the weird thing is that the person who has that secret is integral to the completion of the mystery being unravelled, which brings a whole different undercurrent to the resolution. And the resolution is a nice one. It's not predictable. Nobody gets dragged away in handcuffs, but there's a lovely and very arch and bitchy resolution to this film, which I found really interesting the first time I saw it. I did see it in the cinemas too, way back in the day. I think it was on a double feature. That's how long ago it was, with something else. But I saw it, and I loved the mystery of it, just finding out, unravelling the little bits and pieces, unravelling the puzzles. Was interesting. It's a shame that Sondheim and Perkins didn't write more together. They really had a bit of a talent for mysteries and very much an interest and passion for it. But The Last of Sheila is kind of a cool film in the sense of being well made, being intelligent, being a film that kind of stands alone, a little off to one side of things. It's not a cookie cutter movie the way a lot of films are, where they are now, particularly where they're kind of emulating with slight variations previous movies that were made. This one, they assembled mystery, and it could have been done in as a period piece, as an Agatha Christie kind of thing, with some eccentric little fucker coming along and solving the mystery off from left of screen. But no, not in this case. In this case, they really did want to make a kind of inside joke movie for the entertainment industry, but that was also accessible to the general audience. And I think they very much succeeded in that. It's a really nice semi-forgotten 1970s mystery movie. I kind of like it more than I like films like Murder on the Orient Express, even though that did have a good ensemble. I think this one's kind of got a certain knowingness and a certain archness that, and it doesn't take itself as seriously as a lot of those mysteries that were, particularly the Agatha Christie-based ones that were really big in the 1970s. Those ones really did kind of take themselves way, way too seriously and got all the period detail in it, and but in essence kind of lost that joy of the intellectual discovery of a mystery that I really do appreciate when I'm watching this kind of a film. Anyway, that's pretty much all I've got on The Last of Sheila. Recommend it. I don't know whether it's out on DVD or not, but I do know that it is available. If it is out on DVD, I wouldn't mind getting one with a little bit of a commentary track by somebody knowing. There are two more things to say about The Last of Sheila. The first one is that the name The Last of Sheila has multiple meanings. So there's more than one meaning to the Last of Sheila. Second one, which is interesting in a couple of ways, is that the costumes for the film were done by Joel Schumacher, who later on went on to direct a number of Turkey films, and who himself, like Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim, was very much a friend of Dorothy and still is. So you can see a kind of gay undercurrents in this film. There's a scene where people who are looking for the clues to the puzzle end up in a French lesbian bar, just for a moment. So little bits of undercurrents there that I'd never noticed the first time I saw this film, by the way. I was an incredibly naive young man at the time, and had some weird ideas about homosexuality, to be honest, until I learned better. But, yes, The Last of Sheila, it's worth checking out. It's not a waste of time at all. It's a fun little intellectual mystery, and it's got some very lovely locations and some very bitchy, witty, funny dialogue. Sometimes you might have to wind back and just listen to it again, but there is some really fun dialogue in this film. So I'm going to take another break now, and the next track I'm going to play has kind of a weird connection to movies. There's a scene in the movie Coup de Torchon, also known as Clean Slate, where Philippe Noiret, playing the policeman for the African colonial town in the picture, gets a couple of people who have been teasing him to sing a song. I'm not going to do any spoilers, but if you get a chance to see Coup de Torchon, you'll know what I mean. I'm going to play the song he got them to sing, which is called Catherine Tabella. It's also known as Chi-Chi. And this is the original version from the 1930s by Tino Rossi.
Tu n'as que 16 ans et faut voir comme tu affoles déjà tous les hommes. Est-ce ton œil si doux qui les mine, ou bien les rondeurs de ta poitrine qui les rend fous? Oh, Catherine, ta belle tch, écoute, l'amour t'appelle tch. Pourquoi dire non maintenant? Ah, ah, faut profiter quand il est temps. Ah, ah, plus tard quand tu seras vieille, tch, tu diras baissant l'oreille, tch, si j'avais su dans ce temps-là. Ah, ah, oh ma belle Catherine est Pourquoi donc te montrer si rebelle? L'amour c'est une chose éternelle. Demande-le, crois-moi, à ta mère. Elle l'a chanté avec ton père bien avant toi. Oh Catherine, ta belle tch, écoute, l'amour t'appelle tch. Pourquoi dire non maintenant? Ah, ah, faut profiter quand il est temps. Ah, ah, plus tard quand tu seras vieille, tch, tch, tu diras baissant l'oreille, tch, tch, si j'avais su dans ce temps-là. Ah, ah, ma belle Catherine est Quand tu seras vieille, tch, tch, tu diras baissant l'oreille, tch, tch, si j'avais su dans ce temps-là. Ah, 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 ma belle Catherine est là.
Okay, on to the second film, which in this case is L'Homme de Rio, also known as That Man from Rio, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo, Françoise Dorliac, Jean Servais, and Adolfo Celli. I'll do a little bit of a précis on it, so let me grab my paperwork here. Oh, I grabbed the right one first go. Let me see if I've got a little bit of a synopsis from the Wikipedia. Okay, L'Homme de Rio is a 1964 adventure film directed by Philippe de Broca, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and François Dorliac, who was the sister of Catherine Deneuve. They appeared together in another film that I've podcasted about, being The Young Girls of Rochefort. Coincidentally, Belmondo, who would later star with Deneuve in Mississippi Mermaid. It's a fast-moving Bond-type movie featuring striking locations in Rio de Janeiro and Brasilia and Paris. So, let me see what I've got here. It doesn't have too much about it. I'm going to see if I can find a synopsis for this film, just to give you an idea on why I think you should watch it. Here, I found a kind of half-assed one on IMDb, but I'll see what I can do. A whole bunch of thieves rob a museum in Paris. They ignore the jewels and steal an Amazon figure from the Museum of Man and the Trocadero Palace. They kidnap the world's authority on the lost Maltec civilization, played by Jean Servais. Cut to Agnes, the daughter of a murdered man who possesses one of the two figurines. Moments after... this is a rotten synopsis. Anyway, basically, the Jean Servais character and Agnes, who is the girlfriend of a military man on leave, played by Jean-Paul Belmondo, called Adrien. He's an army private. He's got a week's leave. He turns up to say hi to his girlfriend while he's got the week's leave and suddenly sees her being shuffled into a car by a bunch of thugs. So Agnes is kidnapped, drugged, and loaded on a plane to Paris. And basically the story is how Adrien gets his girlfriend back, his fiancé, ultimately, and stops the bad guys from getting what they want. This movie does not stop from the first minute it starts. It is full on balls to the wall action. Jean-Paul Belmondo, he's a charismatic bugger. He's one of my alternate Eight Magnificent Seven very early days of the podcast. And he is physically, he kind of reminded me of Burt Lancaster in movies like The Crimson Pirate. He's an Energizer Bunny kind of guy, but he looks like what ultimately he used to be, a French boxer. And he kind of follows them through the streets of Paris. There's a car chase. He prangs a motorbike. He gets up and runs onto Orly Airport, fakes his way onto an aeroplane that his kidnapped girlfriend's on. Basically, he dodges everybody to get off the aeroplane in Rio de Janeiro, and the chase is on through Rio and also through a 2,200-kilometer trip to Brasilia, the new capital then of Brazil, which is a striking piece of architecture. If you type into Google Brasilia architecture, you'll see what I mean. It's got this beautiful big scale 1960s futurism, which is incredibly impressive. And it was being constructed at the time, 1963, 1964, when the film was filmed. So it's kind of half futuristic architecture, half building site at the time of this film. And it's a stunning piece of work. And one of the interesting things that I found out is that almost, but not quite, all of the stunts were done by the star, Jean-Paul Belmondo. I'll play you a bit of music to get in the mood, and then I'll tell you what some of the shit this guy gets up to in this film is. This is from the start of the film. Like I said, foreign language films, like I've said before, foreign language films is a bit difficult to play audio, because unless you speak the language in question, the audio is not going to mean a lot to you. But I'll play the music from the start of it. It's kind of got a little bit of the feel of the music from Black Orpheus, but it kind of sets the scene for the pace at which this film does what it does. Okay, let's talk about Jean-Paul Belmondo for a while. He was born in, 1933. Still alive too, and occasionally turns up at film festivals and gets awards for being Jean-Paul Belmondo. His breakout role, of course, was in Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless in 1960, and it kind of made him a poster boy for the French New Wave at the time. And L'Homme de Rio is the one that was his really the big commercial success that he had, that they kind of took, of course Breathless was big, but L'Homme de Rio was enormously big in France and in a number of other places. Doesn't get a lot of coverage over here except among movie buffs, and didn't at the time as well, so it's really odd that that's the case. That's, of course, we've got that tyranny of the language difficulties and subtitles and things. French cinema has always been really, really interesting, but never got a hell of a lot of popularity in the English-speaking world for the simple reason that of that language difficulty, which is a shame because I think French cinema is fantastic myself. Now, François Dauriac was the sister, as we said, of Catherine Deneuve. Unfortunately, she died in a car accident very soon after making Billion Dollar Brain with Michael Caine. Of course, Catherine Deneuve, who her sister was in movies slightly after François Dauriac, Catherine Deneuve became big in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, was her big breakout role on that. But I was thinking about this, and you know how guys are. We think about things like this. I was thinking, okay, young Catherine Deneuve, young Francois Dorliac, which one would you do first? Or, yeah, if you had a choice. And to be honest with you, Francois Dorliac. Now, a lot of people disagree. Catherine Deneuve is a very wonderful actress and also an incredibly attractive woman. But I think one of the things I like about Francois Dorliac in this film particularly is she was willing to be silly. She did some physical comedy in this that was really a lot of fun and very, very beautiful woman, but she was willing to be silly, which is something that a lot of actresses, even to this day, aren't willing to do as a part of their career. They tend to think that because they're beautiful, we should treat them with a certain distance and a certain respect and a certain reverence. But Francois Dorliac in this film doesn't do that. She's drugged for part of the film by the bad guys, and Jean-Paul Belmondo grabs her and tries to get her to out of a bad situation. And she's just... basically, the physical comedy really, really works. And her and Jean-Paul Belmondo seem to be enjoying themselves while they're making this film. So, yeah, she's great. And Jean Servais, you might remember, played Le Stéphanoise in Rafifi, which I've talked about in a previous podcast. I think it's a couple of years ago now. Definitely one of the great actors. He's up right up there with Jean Gabin and people like that, and Eddie Constantine as the kind of cool, crim-looking guys of French cinema in the middle part of the 20th century. He has a kind of role that does a 180-degree turn in the middle of the film. And the other main character we have in this film is Adolfo Celli, who you remember played Emilio Largo in Thunderball and did about 15 or 20,000 Eurospy movies off the back of that afterwards. He was in OK Connery, the one with Sean Connery's brother Neil. He really kind of played on the whole Eurospy spy movie thing until almost the end of his career. Respected actor, but wasn't unknown for him to cash a check now and then. So he's in it as well. And but the basically the motion of this film is Jean-Paul Belmondo. He climbs around the outside of buildings above Copacabana Beach. He climbs around building site scaffolding. He swings through jungle in vines. He swims. He's in an aeroplane. Basically, every action film cliche seems to have started with Jean-Paul Belmondo in L'Homme de Rio. He really does... he's like an energizer bunny. Nothing can stop him. He doesn't need to sleep much. He gets knocked out a couple of times. He's there are attempts by the bad guys to foil him in various ways and to kill him a number of times. There's one main villain who's a really mean-looking Brazilian dude with a scar on his face, and he has about three or four different encounters with Adrian, the Belmondo character, through the film, and comes across as the kind of the main henchman. Bad guy, and he's a tough looking bastard, I tell you. I would not like to go up against him in a machete fight. But it's a joyous film in the way too. It's pure cinema as action. I mean, at the time French cinema was doing a lot of the new wave stuff and really doing some valuable work which became influential and which is of course a joy to revisit nowadays, but this film kind of took a different take. It's pure escapism and going against the grain of a lot of the more serious French cinema. I mean, people probably criticised Belmondo at the time for doing something so frivolous, which isn't to say there were only serious films being made in France at the time. You got Fantomas films with Jean Marais in them, which were silly spoofs and kind of emphasised the contributions of a comedian called Louis de Funès, who played up against, who was the police inspector who tried to foil Fantomas, and those films are a lot of fun too, very kind of Eurospy, very chic. And I figured if I was going to really look like somebody else, I think the coolest thing to look like would probably be a young Jean Marais, because the chicks could not resist you. Really handsome man as a young man. Had a long relationship with Jean Cocteau, But a really good-looking guy, and I'm kind of dithering here and getting off the track of L'Homme de Rio. But what I'm saying is that there wasn't French cinema wasn't just serious new wave stuff any more than it is now. You get serious pieces of French cinema, and you get silly things starring Jean Dujardin as well. I really wish that a lot of this stuff was more available and more accessible to people, because there's some fantastic French cinema coming out at the moment, and going back into the history of it, you can see the similarities and differences between what was happening in English-speaking cinema at the time, and discover some real hidden gems there that you weren't previously aware of. And I'm sure that's the case with a whole bunch of different foreign language cinema that we're not familiar with. I know there was a history in Russia of fantastic cinema where they did a lot of science fiction and fantasy stuff right back after the end of World War II on into the 90s, at least, and into the current day as well, with things like Night Watch. So they've got a tradition of that as well. So fantastic stuff isn't just Michael Bay blowing up a robot while it chews its way through a pyramid in Egypt, which is another reason, I suppose, why Egypt had its revolution. They were totally over having fucking robots eat up the landscape. But anyway, L'Homme de Rio, it's hard to describe. What I should do is I'll put up anything I can find on it at the website, a YouTube clip or something like that, just to give you an idea of the feel for this film. Because talking about it, there's not a lot of audio you can play to it, but the visuals are stunning, and the landscapes and the use of set pieces in various landscapes around Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro and Brasilia, and of course Paris in the 1960s. The thing with the passing of time and seeing a film set in a place almost 50 years ago is that sense of this is what it looked like in the past, that kind of window into the way things were. And that's another reason why I really, really enjoy looking at old cinema. Seeing modern places is fine too, I do any amount of that, but just seeing the way cities used to be and seeing the advertising signs and how people dressed and the kind of vehicles people had is always a nice addition to the joy of a film. And this film's definitely got that. Just looking at the old trams they had in Rio de Janeiro at the time, and the advertising signs, and just the way the extras are dressed, and what they ate, what they drank, how the little shanty town looked at the time. It's just a very visually rich film, and I think it deserves a Criterion release if it hasn't already had one. Let me just check to see whether it hasn't already had one. No, it hasn't, but there's one copy of the film on DVD for sale at Amazon.com for $90. So not every film gets it $90, as in. There's also a couple of VHS tapes of it for sale, so it's one of those films that you're going to have to find another way. It's not hard to do. I found it from a couple of different sources with a few prudent torrent searches. Of course, look for the SRT files, which are the subtitles. But lovely film, and one of my favourite action films of the 1960s. When I kind of make my list, I always add this one to it. There was a VHS release in Australia just before DVDs came out, which I picked up for about $5, but it was a pan and scan version. The version I've got at the moment is widescreen, and of course that does improve how it looks. So I'm going to take another break now and get into the feedback. And we do have feedback. So the time for me to wet my whistle and caffeinate myself slightly more. And I'll be back soon with, I think I'll start off with Dr. Zom. Just want to do a quick addition. I just found out that all of L'Homme de Rio is on YouTube. So you can watch the whole movie on YouTube. So definitely do that. It's widescreen on YouTube, and it's also got the subtitles.
Adios muchachas, compañeras de mi vida, parra querida, de aquellos tiempos, j'ai tant changé qu'on lit sur moi tous mes voyages, oui mais le cœur ne vieillit pas comme un visage, En te quittant, j'avais le goût de l'aventure, mais rien ne dure, c'est ma nature. À part t'aimer, il n'y a rien dont je sois sûr. Me revoici, bonjour amour, bonjour. À mon dernier passage, j'arrivais d'Argentine, je frôlais ton corsage en dansant le tango. Ta voix était câline, la nuit divine. Mais la brise marine m'appelait à nouveau. Je partis le cœur triste, mais je laissais ma peine au long des longues pistes, sous tous les horizons. Et c'est l'âme sereine que je ramène sur ce nouveau poème, notre chanson. Adios muchachas, compañeras de mi vida, barra querida, d'aquellos tiempos. J'ai tant changé qu'on lit sur moi tous mes voyages. Oui, mais le cœur ne vieillit pas comme un visage. En te quittant, j'avais le goût de l'aventure, mais rien ne dure, c'est ma nature. À part t'aimer, il n'y a rien dont je sois sûr. Me revoici, bonjour amour, bonjour. L'âme sereine que je ramène sur ce nouveau poème, notre chanson. Adios muchachas, compañeras de mi vida, barra querida, d'aquellos tiempos. A part aimer, il n'y a rien dont je sois sûr. Me revoici, bonjour amour, bonjour.
That was Tino Rossi again singing Adios Muchachos, which in English was known as I Get Ideas. If you can hear bells in the background, that's because I've been joined by Jill the Kitten, who has decided to play with her cat toys in the library where I record the podcast. So, yeah, just ignore the bells.
And now it's time for What Has Dr. Zom Been Watching?
Paleo Cinema? This is Dr. Zom. I just recently left work, and I wanted to give you a call to speak to you about a film that is near and dear to my heart. And that film is 1955's Soldier of Fortune. Film stars Clark Gable, the King of Hollywood, Susan Hayward, Gene Barry, and Alexander Darcy as René Dupont Chevalier. And so anyway, this is one of my favorite films of Clark Gable. And when you chalk it up to that big old list of favorite movies of all time, I'd put Soldier of Fortune right down on there. It makes me want to squint. It makes me want to grow a mustache, slick my hair back, and kiss some dames that are married to another man. And you could throw that last part in, and I don't give a damn. Anyway, this is a really good movie. I don't know if you've seen it before. I know that you are the master of cinema. Clark Gable is the quote-unquote soldier of fortune, a man of adventure. And they're kind of hanging out over in Hong Kong. Susan Hayward shows up, and her husband has been, well, let's just say he got on the wrong side of the Chinese. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this movie up, besides the cast and besides Clark Gable being in it, is Alexander Darcy. This guy, I mean, is just so full of charisma. He plays a kind of roguish Frenchman who hangs out in a seedy bar. He likes to just, he's kind of a soldier of fortune too, I guess. But anyway, what a cool guy. I mean, he kind of has kind of a funny kind of a sense of humor about his character. But as far as coolness goes, he's right up there with Clark Gable. And Clark is cool as shit in this movie. I like the guy. And I don't think... I know that I have probably seen him in TV shows. And he was in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And he was in a movie with Marilyn Monroe. I'm trying to think what one it was because I saw the picture. How to Marry a Millionaire, where he plays J. Stuart Merrill. Anyway, I had to get the... You got to... when you speak French. But anyway, the guy, I like him. I like him a lot. I don't know if you've seen him in anything else, and if you have any recommendations of any movies that you saw that he was in. He started out in 1927. He hit it big there for a while, starring in that Marilyn Monroe movie and Soldier of Fortune. And then, unfortunately, I believe that he got kind of slogged into TV shows and B-movies. But one of those B-movies was a Roger Corman movie called St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Anyway, Taddy, this is Dr. Zom, rambling on. I just got off work. I'm here with Mariska and the Chief Daniel. I am broiling the steak in the oven, ready to eat. Hope you and your lovely lady and your fine kittens are doing okay. And I'm going to sign off for now because I have to poop. This is Dr. Zom calling from the Peachtree State of Georgia, United States of America, saying Zom oot.
Thanks for that, Zom. I'm so looking forward to the podcast you're doing, mate. It's going to be great, you and Piccolo together. Yeah, Soldier of Fortune. Haven't seen it, but I am hunting it down from the usual sources. Alexander Darcy. Yeah, Alexander Darcy was a weird guy. I'm going to have to check out some of his films. I did a bit of a Wikipedia on him. The guy was Egyptian, and he started out with an Egyptian name. Moved to America, as you do if you're Egyptian, I suppose, and had a long career playing kind of slightly swarthy, charismatic buggers. But I think I've seen him in a couple of things, but I can't recall what. But I'm going to definitely keep an eye out for him. Soldier of Fortune sounds like a bit of fun. And, I did grab my biography of Clark Gable by Warren G. Harris, which was imaginatively titled Clark Gable. And apparently Gable, during the scenes he filmed in Hong Kong for this film, had a clause in his contract saying he could finish work at 5 p.m. every night so he could go on the piss and get drunk and things like that. So, yeah, interesting. He's a very heavy drinker in the evenings. And, the alcohol was getting to him at the time, and it caused a lot of tension on the scenes of making the film. So, yeah. So, apparently, he was also having a bit of a breakdown during that time as well, which is a bit unfortunate. I'm going to have to finish reading this biography. I started it and did get into his very early film career, but got distracted by other things, as you do, and didn't watch it. But Soldier of Fortune, I'm acquiring it from the usual sources, which may include a place that starts with a C and starts with a G, just to let people know. But thank you very much for that, Zom, and I thought I'd do that special intro by Sal just for the wonderfulness of your contribution to this podcast, mate. So keep doing what you do, and all strength to you and Piccolo for your new podcast. I did get an email from Martin Cook, who lives in the city of Churches, Adelaide, which is also the city of wine and the city of German smoked small goods. So just a quick one saying, hey Terry, really enjoyed show 69. Great theme. I need to revisit Barbarella, and he's very curious if it's also on Blu-ray, so we have to check that and try to find a Blu-ray of it. It should be. Criterion have released such stuff as Flesh for Frankenstein, etc., so maybe one day they'll release it. Yeah, I definitely hope so. It's one of those things that I really... You know, Barbarella is just such a very cool and groovy movie, and I do really want to see as clear a copy of it as I can. I also got another comment from someone called Zelda March, who put it onto the hosting website that I have for the podcast. This dates back to a couple of episodes ago when I did 7 Days to Noon. And Zelda March says, enjoyed the podcast, but some more info on 7 Days to Noon. The Oscar for story went to Paul Dean and James Bernard. Dean went on to write the sequels to the Planet of the Apes movies, and Bernard is well known for scoring the most famous Hammer horror films, including Horror of Dracula and Curse of Frankenstein, among others. Thought you might find this interesting. Carry on with the podcast and cheers, Zelda March. Thank you. It's always good to hear new people giving feedback on it. Yeah, 7 Days to Noon is just one of those cool, not known well enough thrillers that I do want to kind of give a bit of oxygen to by doing this podcast. So, yeah, definitely something cool and groovy there. Now, let me just go in. I've got another voicemail, and I'll start that one up, and we'll get on with it.
Hey, Terry, this is Vince Rotolo from Columbia, South Carolina, and I just listened to episode 69. Really great show. Keep them coming, buddy. Yeah, Barbarella is one of my favorites, and you were talking about Raquel Welch. I got the part, but I have to disagree with you. I'd like to see Raquel Welch hit it, because I had a crush on her back when I was in high school. I had her poster hanging up in the bedroom from the Hammer movie she did, 1 million years B.C. or something like that. And also, you know, really good idea on the video t-shirts. If you develop them, I think that's a brilliant idea. And I just want to tell you, if I had one, mine would be showing clips of Clockwork Orange, Enter the Dragon, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, and Taxi Driver. And the last question, I think you'd mentioned, if we wanted to see a remake, would we like to see get remade? And I, for one, would like to see Roger Corman's Attack of the Crab Monsters remade. I think that'd be pretty cool. And I guess that's about it. Just wanted to chime in real quick. Like I said, taking a break here at Moot Plant, and just finished up listening to it. So thanks for all the great shows and the entertainment here at work. Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Thanks, Vince. I think you and I are going to have to agree to disagree about Raquel Welch, which is fine. I mean, there's a diversity of lust interest. I mean, for me, there was, when I was that age, there was things like Yvonne Craig playing Batgirl was really hot, and a few other different people. But I can see the Raquel Welch thing, and even though it's not my kind of thing, definitely. Video t-shirts. I did say, I think it might have been on Facebook or somewhere, that what I'd put on a video t-shirt, amongst other things, would be the climax, if it will, from Behind the Green Door, with the psychedelic superimposition shots and things like that. But I'll probably get arrested for that. Let me think what else I could do. I think it would be really cool to do, you know, when the spaceship's crashing on Planet of the Apes and zooming over the lakes and the desert in Arizona, that kind of stuff would be cool to put on there. Or the chess scene from The Thomas Crown Affair would be good, or the car racing scene from Bullet. I think video t-shirts will get here eventually, and, you know, you stick an SD card in the side of the damn thing and just play what you like on it. I think the technology's almost there, if it isn't quite yet. Flexible displays are starting to come in. I think we're going to see that. And the moment they get programmable, the possibilities for advertising, amongst other things, and of course for self-expression, are going to be enormous. You wait and see. That's my little bit of Criswell prediction for this podcast. And again, Vince, thanks for your support, mate. You do a fantastic job with Mary and Nick and all the other people, Juan, on the B-Movie cast, and all strength to you for that. You're doing great with it, and I always listen to your show. So I'll get on with the next bit.
Hey, this is Richard in Wichita, just touching base. Wanted to leave some comments in regards to your most recent episode, number 69, Purple Barbarella. Loved the, in particular, the discussion on Barbarella. This is a movie I haven't seen since the late 80s. It's a movie I've only seen, I believe, twice. I know that I saw it when I started working at a video store in the late 80s. And then I know that I've seen it once on television in an edited form. You know, I'm a big sci-fi fan, and this movie, I guess, bleeds into that sci-fi category. It's not one of my personal favorites. It's just a little out there for me. But, you know, this is a movie that I might go ahead and put on to rewatch list sometime in the near future. Of course, that list is, you know, 10 million miles long, but things will get bumped up to the top of the list, especially as I'm listening to various podcasts, and if I hear a particular movie discussed that either I haven't seen or I haven't seen in a very long time, I'll be prone to go ahead and bump it up the to-watch list. So I think I might have to go ahead and check out if this is available on Netflix and add it to the old queue. With that said, sorry to hear about all of the weather problems you've been having down there, and it just doesn't seem to be getting any worse, or any better, rather. We have had our fair share here in the U.S. as well. I live in Kansas, which is smack dab in the middle. We have no mountains, trees, forests, lakes, anything around us, so when the warm southern air blows, it comes in blowing, and when the cold northern air blows, it comes in, and we are very prone to huge weather extremes. I'm not a fan of the terminology behind global warming. I do think the overall concept, though, is obviously, you know, it's something we can't ignore anymore. I'm not convinced that mankind has necessarily done this. I am more so a proponent that the Earth is going through one of its natural sets of changes. I think mankind has kind of accelerated things. I think, you know, you'd be stupid to say that that's not the case, but I know a lot of people are on different sides of the fence or different levels. I've heard the extremes that people are, you know, that mankind is 100% responsible for this, and I just strongly disagree with that. I think, you know, if anything, history shows that the Earth has gone through numerous changes, and I think we are witnessing the latest set of changes. You know, we've been hearing about weather extremes for quite a long time now, and I really think in the last 5 years or so, we're really beginning to see that. But again, I'm not quick to point the blame at any one particular person. I think we've accelerated the situation, but we're getting our fair share here. that's you can't deny it. We talk about extremes in the last 30 days. I mean, we've had, you know, snow in the middle of January, which is not uncommon, but then 2 weeks later, we hit 72 degrees on a Friday afternoon. And then literally 4 days later, we were in the midst of a snowstorm and dangerous sub-zero wind chills. I figured out that from that Friday to 4 days later, in a four-day period of time, we had dropped 101 degrees by the time you factor in the wind chill. That's unheard of. Even yesterday morning, we had a record temperature of 17 degrees below zero. And it's supposed to be in the 60s by the middle part of next week. Doesn't make much sense. Anyway, just some ramblings, and I thoroughly agree with you that I think anyone who says we're not going through something is in total denial. We certainly are. Just not sure exactly what the cause is. I think it's part of a natural cycle myself, and there's very little we can do about it. We can change some of our habits, but that's going to require a global effort, and I just, I guess I'm a bit of a pessimist. I just don't see that happening at this point. In any case, back to movies. Loving the show, as always. I myself, probably the best thing I have seen recently, and I'll share this with you, is the movie Let Me In. Now, it's the remake of Let the Right One In, and I'm not a fan at all of Hollywood deciding to do remakes of films simply because younger audiences can't bother to read subtitles and they don't like dubbing. With that said, I really enjoyed Let Me In. This is the first, I think, official movie from Hammer since they made their return. You know you're in for a good film when the Hammer logo at the beginning has a montage of Hammer posters. I mean, clearly they're recognizing their past, and I think that's fantastic. You know, it was very, very good. Chloe Grace Moretz from Kick-Ass, I thought, did a really good job. And the director in the extras on the Blu-ray clearly loved the story, loved the original, and his main reason for making the film was to get the audience, or, you know, get the film to a wider audience. It's sad that the original film couldn't get a wider audience, and it's really sad that this one didn't get much of a wider audience either. It kind of got lost in the shuffle here in the States. It came out in October, which you would think would have been a perfect time, Halloween and everything, but it got overshadowed by much lesser films, such as Wes Craven's My Soul to Take, which was absolutely horrible, and you know, Saw 75 in glorious 5D, whatever the heck that. I mean, I watched it. I did see the Saw film, but certainly on a very different caliber. Hopefully, Let Me In gets that kind of a cult status, and now that it's out available on Blu-ray and DVD, that people will get a chance to watch it that didn't get a chance in the theaters because it kind of went in and went out. I would highly recommend it. Some good extras are on the Blu-ray, and definitely a really good film. Definitely, you know, not a standard vampire flick, and I think that might turn some people off who are looking for a, shall we, you know, the new goth vampire, the Twilight, which makes me cringe just to mention it. There's no sparkling vampires in Let Me In. Let's just leave it at that. In any case, sir, take care, stay dry, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Richard. Let Me In. I'm going to see it. I'm going to see it on DVD at some stage. I've got it on my list of DVDs to be sent in the mail. Mostly the goodwill I have towards it is because it's a Hammer film and I want to encourage Hammer. One of the things I did in 2004 when Sal and I visited London was I found Hammer House, which is on Little Curzon Street or Old Curzon Street or something like that, and took some photos of the building where Hammer's headquarters were. And it was one of the kind of iconic things that I did while we were in London. One of the other things that we did was we went to Port Miriam, which is where the TV series The Prisoner was filmed, and kind of toured around the village and had a groovy time with that. And one of the other things I did was I went to see the statue of the comedian Eric Morecambe on the shores of Morecambe Bay, and I got a big buzz out of that as well. And we did a bunch of other stuff as well. But anyway, I will see it, and I'll let everyone know what I think of it when I do. As far as the global warming thing is concerned, yeah, something's happening. People who realize it's happening, I think, are on the same side with this. One of the most intelligent things I've heard said about this is that it's happening. If it's happening and we don't do anything, it's a disaster. And if it's not happening and we do something, there's no foul. So I think we've got a little bit past that now. We know it's happening. I think that we can contribute to minimizing it. And I think we're an adaptable species. We'll adapt to this stuff. For instance, at the moment in Melbourne, we're getting about 80-90% humidity, which never happens at this time of year in Melbourne, and we're getting a ton of rain. In fact, I just walked through a flooded path this morning myself, which is normally just a trickle, and it went up to mid-thigh when I walked the path and across the park. Got my pants and my shoes wet, but that's neither here nor there. I was on my way back from going for a walk, and unfortunately, because of that wet weather, global warming actually damaged me today. I slipped on some mud and took a bit of a tumble. I'm a bit bruised, but not damaged. I've got a sprained wrist around the base of my thumb, kind of that area and those muscles there, and I'm feeling a little sore in various places, and that's because of global warming. I mean, people talk about the big effects of global warming. My fucking wrist hurts. So So thank you very much for the feedback on that, Richard. Always appreciate that. Barbarella, definitely watch it again. And, you know, I've been a science fiction fan myself. I've been going to conventions since 1979. More the literary ones. I've been to 4 world cons. So I'm definitely on your side with that. And I really should dig out a few more interesting old science fiction movies to do as well, and maybe somebody will nominate me for a Dipmo Award or something at some stage. But anyway, that's all the feedback I got, so I'm going to wrap this puppy up now. It's gone longer than most other podcasts I've done. Keep watching your movies, people, and keep communicating about them with the... we've got the opportunity with social networking to do that now, and I'm having conversations with a few people about films through Facebook mostly, but there are other means as well. I'm doing the Mizzo thing, as I said. Always feel warmed and really treasure the connections I make with people by doing this podcast and by doing the social networking thing. People who bitch about Twitter and Facebook and Foursquare and all those other things just don't understand it. They don't understand that even though it's a different kind of communication with other people, it's still communication with other people, and that's what we're doing. Just thought I'd let you know too that next week on my radio gig in Darwin, I'm going to be talking about Blazing Saddles with Ivor. We're going to do fart jokes basically for 20 minutes to half an hour. The week after that, we're skipping it, and the week after that, on the 11th of March, I'm going to be live in the studio at ABC Darwin, grooving and having a chat with Ivor about the first film I did in Paleo Cinema Podcast, which is The Bad and the Beautiful. So I'm going to have a fantastic time doing that. As I said, 2 weeks from now, you're going to get another podcast from me. 2 weeks after that, you're going to get a music podcast. I don't know what I'm doing in the next one yet, but I'm going to find something obscure as usual. So everyone take care, you know, stay out of the weather if the weather's being unkind, give your puppies a hug for me, Zom, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye.